listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Tracy K. Smith's beautiful memoir, Ordinary Light, is a chronicle of coming into selfhood. It's a meditation on what it means to be both a daughter and a mother, what it means to have a mother, and what it means to lose a mother. Smith grew up in a Northern California town, Fairfield, near Travis Air Force Base, where her father was stationed. Her father found his way out of the South by enlisting in the military, and she reveals in her memoir how she grasps, in fragments over time, the reality of her parents' Southern roots, their journey from the cotton culture of the South to the California suburbs, and she learns what that cost them and what that means to her. She uses her poet's eye to delve into the life of her family and herself and the social, psychological, and historical terrain that informs them. As the last child at home out of five, Tracy Smith grew up with a sense that her mother belonged to her, and her coming of age was earned at the price of contradicting her mother's teachings. The book begins with the moment her mother leaves this earth at the end of her terminal illness and looks backward through time at the years spent together in closeness and then varying distance as the poet establishes her selfhood. And as a reader, I found this a mesmerizing journey. Tracy Smith is the author of three books of poetry, The Body's Question, which won the Cave Canem Prize for the best first book by an African-American poet, Duende, winner of the James Laughlin Award, and Life on Mars, which won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. In 2014, she was awarded the Academy of American Poets Fellowship. And in conversation with Tracy tonight, we have one of LA's great writers and reporters, Linnell George. Linnell was a longtime staff writer at both the Los Angeles Times and the LA Weekly. You can read her now as an arts and culture columnist for KCET's Artbound. She's the author of No Crystal Stair, African Americans in the City of Angels. And recently she's been walking and photographing Los Angeles, and she'll be showing some of those photographs and the poetry of what she sees here on July 9th in collaboration with poet Maricela Norte, who might even be nearby tonight, and DJ Frosty of Dublab. So please join us for that. And now please join me in welcoming Linnell George and Tracy K. Smith. Thank you.
Hello. All right. I'll put my eyes on.
Okay.
I'm so excited to be having this conversation. And now with a whole bunch of other people, too. And I was saying that to her just back there, is that I have so many questions, and I'm probably not going to be able to get to them all. But thank you.
Thank you.
Your book was just gorgeous, and as I was saying just a few minutes ago, that I'm so happy that you are out there and you're telling this story, because we need to have more documentation of these stories. About African-American families and in this period. And so I'm going to be talking to you more about that specifically. But I wanted to just start out about talking to you about just the subject matter and your process. I mean, you so beautifully evoke, you know, wandering through, navigating these like dark, uncertain places, you know, in this book, the loss of your mom, but also identity and trying to find, you know, your place and faith and what faith means and belief and unbelief or searching. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that as well. So I'm just really grateful and so welcome to have you like showing a light on this path. So I just wanted to start with is asking you, how did this book begin to take shape for you? I mean, you know, what made you decide to, you know, go a prose route rather than poetry?
Mm. Well, I knew I wanted to write specifically about my mother for a long time, for, you know, pretty much from the moment of losing her. Mm. And a lot of the poems that I was writing when I was a student were about that, but I was too close to the loss, and so there was something forced. I was trying to fix something that's fundamentally unfixable.
Right.
And so I let go of that material for the most part for almost 2 decades.
Oh, wow.
And then when I had my first child, I realized that a lot of the questions that I had about who I was as a woman and who the people that I come from are were questions that I also wanted to explore for my children. Mm-hmm. And having written a few poems about my mother and then about my father who passed away more recently, I realized that I wanted to switch genres as a way of... I think writers do this all the time. You know, the self-conscious reason is you don't want to repeat yourself.
Right.
But the more, like, selfish reason is I want to learn something different than I've already learned to learn the genre that I normally write.
So you thought you could trick yourself into, like, telling the story in a different kind of way.
Exactly.
From a different angle.
I feel that in poetry, and this is something I love about poems, that they're expansive, elusive. You can leap away from the main idea. In fact, I believe that it's crucial to the success of a poem to leap away from the main idea. And yet this was a main idea that I wanted to delve into without recourse to these other kinds of, offshoots. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it was a sort of scary process in a way.
So then sinking yourself into prose, I mean, how did you decide to do it? Did you kind of trick yourself into that, like writing little bits and pieces, or how did you start?
Yeah, I had no idea what this book was really about. I knew that there was an urge. I knew that I wanted to think about my mom. But the first version of this, or the first number of, I don't, I wouldn't even call it a draft, but covered everything, you know, like much more than anyone needs to know, much more than belongs together. And fortunately, I was working at the time with a mentor through an arts program.
That's great.
And he said, this is about your mother. This is a family story. So all this other stuff, just table it. Mm-hmm. You come back to it in another way, but think about your mother as maybe the central through line here. Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful to me because even, you know, as I realized there were other themes I wanted to talk about, like race.
Right.
Religion was related to my mother, but it also, I think, in this book kind of takes a private life of its own. Those were things that returning to the place that my mother occupied in my childhood and then in my, you know, adulthood as an absence, it was kind of helpful in terms of shaping the types of... questions that I explored, or even inviting some of the memories in. Well, but I had no idea what. I just knew I needed to work some things out.
And it's in terms of like reanimating her. Then, how did you begin? Well, let me back up a little bit because I went through. We were talking a little bit about this too. I went through some of this same thing. Our moms, you know, both died of the same thing, colon cancer, and so. I remember a lot of people asking me as I was going through this process, like, are you writing about it? Are you writing about it? And I was like, that was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. There was something it was too formal. It was too, it made things seem more real. Mm-hmm. So I wanted the distance. Did you write during the period? Were you keeping any kind of notes, or this was all?
This is recovered. I was writing during that period, but I wasn't writing about us at all. Yeah. I had really, I think, recently come to poetry as something that I wanted to kind of, I would say very shamelessly to my college roommate, I'm giving my life to this.
I was like,
but it was true. It, writing,
I'm saving myself for poetry.
Writing poems made me feel like I had control and like I could right. understand things. But of course, what I was writing about wasn't the stuff that I had
right.
the most urgent need to explore because that was too hot.
Right.
So I was writing, you know, poems that had to do with, you know, just anything.
Anything but.
But right. What I think that does for anyone is, and this is what I believe language does. I think that no matter what you're writing about, if you succumb to what language asks or requires of you, you are going beyond what's apparent, and you're marrying the words to a set of feelings that you hadn't even necessarily understood until the word showed you what it was.
Exactly.
And it's a kind of, you know, like conversation that you're having. I don't really still know what it's with. I imagine it's with the unconscious mind, and I hope it's with something bigger than that too. But I was really excited by what that did for me. I felt like it allowed me to look at just anything, the ordinary features of my 22-year-old life, and to realize that if I looked at small things in the right way, they could become something larger than themselves. And that's what I think I understood language was about. And I understood that if I could just keep doing this one day, I might get to a place where I could write about this thing.
There's these beautiful segments and moments in the book where I can see your hand on the page, mm-hmm. and you're talking about being able to connect with something as you're watching your hand work. And there is something like, you know, especially in your 20s, you know, and you're a young woman and like realizing, oh, this is taking me someplace. I have no idea where I'm going, and I feel strong for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and there's power in that. But then to switch it back, though, I mean, so much time passed between, you know, this event with your mom and you deciding to write about it. What was the process of reanimating your mother?
Mm. Well, there are some things that just emerged because they never went away.
Mm.
You know, there were some memories that were so fundamental and so close to the surface that I could just dip into them and follow where they led. And they're not always the very loud ones, but
like what?
Like there's a scene in the beginning of part of the book where my family and I go to a farm. I grew up in Northern California. There are a lot at that time. What has now become just kind of a sprawling suburb was a lot of like these ranches and little quiet communities. And so we went to this farm and collected fruit, and I got kicked by a calf in the stomach. So that was a memory that I was on the skin. And the funny thing was that writing about one thing and kind of allowing the slow process of language, inviting sensations to return, opened up, or I like to think of it as almost dislodged these other memories.
Yes.
So I'd write a chapter, and then I'd say, oh, that was right around the same time that this other thing happened.
Right.
And I didn't know what this other thing was really about, but if I could commit to writing about it, then maybe I would learn something from it. And sometimes those things didn't get included.
Right.
Other times they felt like they were purposeful in a way. But there were also, I think, you know, tricks that people use, photographs that helped, you know, activate memories, or, you know, I know for many of us, it's true that photos really constitute the memory. And I just trusted that as well. Or there was a moment when I bought my mother's perfumes that she wore and, that
joy.
Yeah. Joy.
I did do it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that really brought a lot. I mean, not necessarily narrative,
right,
but this sense of feeling.
Yeah.
Which is,
you said music too, right? What did you play?
Oh gosh. A lot of 70s and 80s things. So there was a Lou Rawls period.
Of course there was.
Bill Withers,
yeah.
The George Benson period.
And what did that conjure? Was it like the life of the house, parties, that
sort of thing? Yeah, it was the life of the house, and then also a kind of privacy, I think, maybe because I think we all have this, but I also imagine that maybe mine was felt more spacious because I was there was a bigger gap between me and everyone else. So these songs also brought me back to these moments where I didn't really need language to, you know, link me to someone else or even clarify what I was feeling. But it allowed me to kind of feel the palpable sense of that time and maybe employ language to explore it or translate it.
There was one detail too, and I mentioned it to you before too, but this is this idea, and this is a good way for us to kind of segue into this idea about faith and her faith. That around the house when you were like, you were remembering the books in the house, and you said you saw, she had the little pamphlets, the Daily Bread. And so she would read that, and it was this part of her ritual and her faith. She was, you mentioned throughout the book about your mother's searching, and she's this spiritual quest that she's on, but you can't put your finger on it. Now that you're finished with this book, are you closer to you're an idea of what you think she might have been searching for.
I feel like I am. I also wonder if the narrative that the book encouraged me to shape informs that, and maybe it's the wrong answer. But what I surmise now is that, you know, my mother was a military wife and for decades was moving every couple of years.
Right.
This is also in the time when my dad would have been away for months at a time. I didn't even realize this. In the book, I think I say I was about 9 months when my dad came home after I was born. But I recently was talking to my brother, and he said, no, you were like a year and a half.
Wow.
Like, our father had been stationed in, you know, Asia for so long. And so I met him when I was a toddler. And so imagine a wife with 5 kids at home and just trusting that everything was okay out there. And I think there was a deep kind of loneliness. And, and now as a parent, I realize there's also so many questions and frustrations and how I'm responsible for all these lives and my own too. And how do I do this? And I think that God became a kind of home for her.
Yes.
I think that she was, you know, far from her people. And the friends that she had were sort of temporary friends because everybody was on the same cycle of moving. So I think God became an anchor.
An anchor. You know, it's interesting because I was really struck by that too. That her, clearly she was lonely. But there was those 2 moments where she connects with those people. It's Maggie, the first woman, who she invites home. And I love this line where you say, you observe as a child, like, she didn't show her true self. She didn't show her the thing that Maggie would like about her. She was able to do it later with another woman she brought home, a friend. What do you think, what was she trying to protect? Or was she just shy? What was going on, do you think, in that moment?
Oh, God.
So poignant. You know, here's this woman who's craving, you know, company
and
a connection to the South and the home and the language. And yet she just shut the door.
Yeah, I don't know. As a parent now, there are so many moments when my 5-year-old, who is very willful and amazing and spirited, does exactly the opposite of what I'm like silently begging her to do, especially if there are other people involved. And she could perform a version of Us that would make me look like the best mother in the world, and she doesn't do that one.
No, because like, you want that, right?
Thing, you know. And I think we all do that. Mm-hmm. I think my mother probably did that to herself too.
Mm-hmm. Like your Halloween costume.
Yeah.
You know, but there are all these things where she probably was thinking, I want to support you. And she did, clearly. And then there was this thing where there's something else going on. And so she would like pull her hand or hold her hand in some way.
Yeah.
I'm curious too, though, about your father. It's clearer about your mother and her, how faith organized her life, the structure, you know. But with your father, it's different because of the science, and the military. And I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about how faith informed his life and the way you saw it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, before I wrote this book, I thought that they were this unified front. And they were the people in the front seat of the car on Sunday, and we were the ones, kids going to church. And not always, you know, sometimes against our will. And so I felt like it was the same thing for them. But as I was thinking back, I realized that my mother's urge toward religion was different. It was rooted in a spiritual quest. And my father's, though I think he considered himself a believer, and you know, we prayed as a family over meals. I think it was an organizing principle that had to do with structure.
Mm-hmm.
I know both my parents came from Alabama, and the Black church, they grew up in the 30s and 40s, came of age in the early 50s, before the civil rights movement. So the church was a means of community, but it was also a way of saying there's a larger sense of justice that's real, and we can direct our sights on that. We can be beholden to this other sense that is fair and that understands us and that made us. It's also, I think, one of the things that, you know, gives family a sense of rigor. You know, you have this church community and these values. And I think that's something that my parents were really interested in bringing to us as children, and giving shape to that domestic life, giving us a sense of connection to a tradition that predated all the spanking newness of California. Mm-hmm. And so for, you know, my father, I imagine that was what weighed in most clearly. Although I know it was more than that for him too, even though he was an engineer, and I know he was really fascinated by science. And when I was very young, I remember him, you know, the debate about, it's still going on, if you can believe, if, why should we believe, the debate over creation and evolution is still a hot topic. But it's, my father felt so easy and comfortable saying, oh, well, you know, if 7 days in this realm is like 7 million years of God's realm, who cares? Right. Like, isn't that exciting? Let's look at evolution. Right. So he found ways of bringing that in and changing the terms with which he examined these other things. But I think they were comfortable allowing these tenets of life that they'd grown up with to serve the needs that they had in the moment. Mm-hmm.
I know, too, and I had wanted to ask you to read a little bit at the very beginning, but this may be a good place to do it as well, because I know as your mother became more ill, I'm starting to wonder about, like, I know she was kept, there's that line where she says, well, God can heal me. You know, not he will, but he can. Mm-hmm. And your father, I'm wondering, like, what was going on in his head? You know, I know he was there to support your mother, you know, in her illness and, like, take care of you. But I'm wondering what was going on in their heads. And so maybe this might be a good time for you to read a little bit from
that. Okay, sure. I mean, I can never really know. I know my dad was very scared.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ease with which I saw him do everything else sort of evaporated at that time.
Yeah, yeah. And that idea about being brave, you know, my dad certainly said that to me, you know, mm-hmm. you know, we need to be brave.
Yeah, which at the time feels like, you know, like I hated myself for not being able to disengage from the critical perspective that said that's in every movie.
Right, exactly. I know.
But it's also the only thing it's true.
Yeah.
It's really true. Yeah. So it's a strange moment. I'm just going to read a couple of pages from a chapter that would have taken place right after my mother's death called A Strange After. I believe she wanted to keep living, but she wasn't hung up on it. It makes sense now, the way she'd said that God could heal her, meaning it was within his power, up to him, just as he could choose not to, and instead to call her home, to let her live in the ever after she always believed was beyond this one. Having her there made it real, not the frivolous cartoon place I'd tried to convince my cousin Nina of when we were kids, the one with gold-paved streets and block after block of identical mansions, but someplace with purpose. A place where my mother's faith and her goodwill might be reunited with her spirit's original amplitude, so that she was large, larger than all of us who grieved her, larger than the world as she had known to imagine it, or the God in whom she had trusted, who was larger and stranger than she'd known to imagine him. In the days preceding her funeral, the house was full, and we moved through the blur of actions that always fills in the space between someone's death and our ritual for saying goodbye. I was surprised at what it felt like, surprised enough that I wondered if what I was feeling was really what I felt, an empty, groggy disbelief coupled with an unexpected relief, as if the long build-up to letting go was almost worse than the silent free-fall of afterward. That wasn't it exactly, but at least finally there was a name for what I felt, grief, a shape to try to fit it into. There were words, sanctioned words I might offer or collect, like the dull, heavy coins of that new realm. There were times, lots of them, when someone would offer to pray with me. I never said no. I possessed no inclination to take God to task for my mother's death. Didn't find it difficult to think of her death as something that had happened to her rather than me, some twist or fold in her destiny that had only just brushed against mine. My mother had been so adamant about the afterlife that she'd forbidden us from making a shrine of her grave. Bury me in a simple pine box and don't visit my body in the ground. I won't be there. She'd said it almost happily, triumphantly, as if doing such things might constitute proof that heaven is real, and we came as close to doing what she'd asked as the funeral industry would allow. Issuing the brushed titanium Cadillac of coffins and choosing instead the plainest oak. At the burial, we stood around the gravesite in our dark mourning clothes. Pastor Ganey spoke, I'm sure, movingly, powerfully, but my mind would not stay still. Is she with us now, or has she already gone? And if she goes, can she ever come back? I thought of her watching our flimsy bodies, our bowed heads and put-upon shoulders, with a tenderness and a clarity beyond our ability to grasp. How miniature our lives must have looked from there, and how utterly bereft we must have seemed, standing over the hole in the earth that would never contain her.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. So you, all, I mean, this is going on. I know there's this also this other image I think about too now, where you keep looking up at the ceiling, like where to see where she's gone. Like that becomes this image for you, a symbol. But this also looking up is also a looking is a hopeful thing as well for you. This is not a simple question at all, but I know you struggled, you also trying to figure out, okay, what does faith look like now? What does faith look like now for you?
I feel like I spent so many years, it's funny, you know, I grew up in this family where God was so real and so permanent, always there, like the, you know, like extra person in the room. That
station wagon.
Yeah. It never could go away, no matter what kind of skepticism I might have been allured by. I couldn't really absorb that. I was somebody who believed, and that's that. So I was never really concerned with trying to outwit that. But I wanted to find a kind of comfort in that because I felt extremely uncomfortable by a lot of the trappings of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the... What I really think it comes down to is the public aspects of Christianity.
Right.
Where what you're doing is not only connecting to your private sense of this divinity, but also creating a persona that other people can admire and
exactly.
emulate if you're lucky. And I didn't like what that made happen in my family.
Right.
I think God was real to, I know God was real to my mother, but I also know that her sense of herself as a parent was informed by this,
right.
by the pressure to be the one who would raise children in the right way.
Right way, right.
And I felt, you know, kind of trapped and a little bit judged by what that made happen.
Right. Well, you had those experiences the churches where they were all praying for you
yeah.
when you went to college, you know, like, oh, Tracy, you know, maybe
yeah.
up to.
Fallen.
No good. Fallen Tracy, you know. And how public that was. I mean, to walk around thinking like people are looking at you or they had changed. Like when, even in your home where you would, I think you, it's at the point where you go to like put a record on or something and someone
oh,
in your
yes.
home is staring at you in this very strange way. Like,
and it's a disappointed or
so disappointed, yeah.
Sort of like just the judgment. It's judgment, right? I mean, Christians are obsessed with judgment, right? God's final judgment.
Right.
I think humans are. You know, we come up with a lot of
we want to put
versions.
Ourselves in a category.
Yeah,
where, yeah.
I mean,
it's like hierarchy.
I mean, it's a human need, right. and the language Christianity offers for that is really right. remarkable. but I, for me now, having moved through that and I kind of felt that it was also kind of connected to just the bumps of coming of age, I really believe that I do lean toward something. Mm-hmm. I know my last book of poems was really an effort, a private effort to get it outside the shape of the Sistine Chapel
right.
God.
Right.
And to imagine that the scale and the scope and the mystery mm-hmm. of the and the order of the
right.
universe
right.
might be something that's compatible with a figure. Mm-hmm. And that was just a private thing I didn't even realize I was doing until I realized what I had done.
Right.
And I
letting your hand tell you.
Yeah.
Again.
So, I feel like in a way that's where I am. I have a sense that there's a largeness that I'm very interested in and that is somehow connected to any and everything that I'm drawn to. Poetry is a big part of it,
right.
Even if I don't necessarily feel that I'm writing like religious poetry right. in any way, but I feel like there's an urge toward a mystery that language is a really interesting tool for mm-hmm. exploring. As a parent, I definitely feel something akin to what my mother must have felt, mm-hmm. which is a kind of helplessness. I can do everything I can, and then there are so many things to fear,
right.
and if there's anything I can call upon, right. I'll do it.
Right. Right.
I don't care what right. other people have to say about that.
Right.
And I feel like it's kind of like the thing where you come up with your own private sense of what works.
Right. Even if, like you said, it's like even if it's like your father, even if it's going to order your thoughts, and so that there isn't all that chaos, and you can think. You know, the moment that worry sets in, you're just I'm going to call on something.
Yeah. You know? I kind of also felt eager once I got over the anxiety of writing about this stuff. I felt eager to do it because, you know, I'm an artist, I'm an academic, and this isn't the kind of stuff we talk about.
Right.
Nobody right. says Jesus.
Right.
You know? And I wanted to push back against that a little bit and also challenged myself to out that mm-hmm. side of myself.
Right.
Because I think, you know, faith is real.
Right.
And it's a problem that's as complex and worth contemplating and wrestling with as global warming
right.
or, you know, like the crisis of the humanities. Like, these are things
right, right.
that we can apply our gifts to. So I wanted to bring that conversation into a place where it seemed excluded.
Well, when you were talking, you just said, used the word anxiety. I mean, were you worried about, like, you know, talking about all of this in a book? I mean, there's so much else that we haven't even gotten to yet. You know? But the anxiety was about talking about religion, talking about spirituality. What was it?
Oh, everything. Talking about, you know, coming of age, talking about race.
Yeah.
You know, America's a funny place because we tell ourselves the only people who can talk about race are the people who are obviously raced. So
right.
in one sense,
right.
I'm supposed to
right.
be talking about it, but in another sense, I'm different from every other person who looks just like me, and I felt like some of the things I would say must not sort of line up with what other people would say, and that was a nervous-making realization.
Right.
But thankfully, and I think a lot of writers are like this, you try and push away any thought of the external world while you're working on mm-hmm. something, and it's really just a private
right.
pursuit.
Right.
And so anytime I would come up for air and start worrying about those things, I would just kind of bury myself again in the moment and see if I could forget about it until it was too late.
Right, exactly. You've gotten too far.
Yeah.
You're in the center of the, you know, in the middle of the water, you know. But that is one thing I did want to talk to you about for sure, is that this idea of, like, writing about race in a way that we don't often get to see, where you talk about feeling like an interloper, you know, in so many ways in your life. And there's this great line of your dad's where you guys move to your new community and he looks at you and looks at you guys and says, don't let this place put strange ideas in your head, you know. And I think so many of us who had that experience had similar talks, you know, with our parents, or, you know, or a warning, like, don't put on airs. Don't lose your sense of self. Don't lose your anchoring. But at the same time, there's all these other things that you're supposed to be thinking, you know, like, okay, be better than everybody, but don't be too good. Don't be too proud, but be proud. How are you able to begin in synthesizing all of this as a kid? Do you remember that kid self and what it was like to push off into that ocean?
Well, I just remember the small part of it, smaller parts of it, you know, these like encounters that brought certain features of that sensibility into focus. Mm-hmm. So having a childhood friend say, don't you wish you were white?
Yeah.
And knowing somehow what was riding on my answer to that question at age
yes.
like six.
Six, Yeah.
Knowing the answer.
Even playtime was a minefield. It really was.
I mean, I think this is something that I didn't think that this was a public conversation that America needed to have, but thinking about all of the ways in which we are nowhere farther than we were 50 years ago in terms of race,
right,
and injustice, I feel like this is a conversation that needs to happen publicly in all of its different aberrations, because, you know, the question that a white friend asks, is it innocent in a way? But it also kind of reveals a number of assumptions.
Right.
But I think at root, it's a question that says, what is it like to be you?
Right.
And that's a question we've found so many ways not to ask.
Yes.
And it's almost the only question that we need to ask, you know?
Right.
If we really wondered that about one another from moment to moment in our lives, how could we do the things that we do to one another,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I don't know how I got to that, but...
But it's, well, it's the writing. You're writing out loud, you know? And it's, but it's true. It's like the, I can't remember the young woman's name, but you who had befriended, who just kept referring to you, is like, hey, black girl. Hey, black girl. And you let her know how you felt like you had let her know how you felt about it, but it continued in that moment where you're exchanging the photographs and you don't want to look to see what she's inscribed the photograph with, because this is going to be, you know, part of, you know, your legacy of, you know, like my memory of school. Mm-hmm. And this is the way people think of you, that black girl, you know, beyond who you really are or what you meant to her. And that's the thing, these moments, and this is what, to me, was so important about this book, is that you were able to, like, really, like, home in on these things that happen, and there's so many of them, like the question about, you know, don't you wish you were white, or don't you wish this? I know so many friends who, and this is the thing that really struck me, I hadn't even thought about it until you wrote it, where, like, all these things are happening to us individually, but we never talked about them. I mean, yeah. I had black friends in school. We did talk about certain things, but we didn't always talk about these really, like, raw things that happened to us.
Yeah.
You didn't
it's crazy, the sense of shame that you carry, not because of who you are, but because of the complications that your identity raises for others,
right,
if that makes sense. And this is something, you know, that I think is unique to the other.
Right.
And this is really what we mean by white privilege.
Right.
You don't necessarily have to worry about this.
Right.
But it's also important to realize that other people do.
Right.
And so thinking about what it means to, you know, yeah, confuse, mm-hmm, alarm, and also realizing that, or imagining that it's a burden that you must bear.
Right.
Even if you know every other friend that looks like me must also have experienced,
right,
this, but let's not dig it up.
Right.
Let's just let it lie.
Let's go put on a record, you know, or something else.
I mean, I don't think that necessarily overrides a whole host of other feelings that blacks feel,
right,
you know? I don't want to say that this is like a terrible burden, but it's a presence,
mm-hmm,
and it's something that is so often relegated to silence,
mm-hmm,
and that seems strange to me, you know? I can also understand it.
Right.
And the other thing I feel like I want to say is that none of these things were clarified to me in the moment, you know? And mm-hmm, this is what I think writers are really after. It was going back to the time of having this high school friend who called me black girl and being able in the, you know, in language to slow things down and move around within those moments where at the time I was like, you know, like,
right,
and kind of think.
Right.
And to bring language that I, as an adult now, have or perspective to these very poignant emotional silences or like just blurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's what the writing allowed me to do, was to kind of give a sense of not only narrative, but also insight,
right,
to a lot of these.
You
like
finally put that tile into place, mm-hmm, where it belongs, which actually does connect to this idea, too, about the South. And I, as I was reading, you know, like your family comes from the South, but and you go and you visit the South, yet you feel this distance from the South and uncomfortableness about the South and about that history and the pain. And pain keeps coming up, you know, and the strangeness of it. And I'm sitting here thinking, wow, she's been there and she's still. And through books and through writing is your way into being able to understand. But you talk a little bit about not being able to hear or not wanting to hear, I guess, mm-hmm. too, the stories about Jim Crow in the South and why that was such a hard thing for you to be able to absorb.
Yeah. I think the simplest way to say it is it felt so personal. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a classmate of mine from third grade on who was the other black kid in my class, the only other black kid for a few years. And every February, Black History Month, he would say, I don't want to talk about slavery. And I knew what he meant. Yeah. It hurts.
Yeah.
It's like,
oh, yeah.
Why did this happen to me or to not, you know, to the people that I come from?
Right.
And there's a sense of pain. And a child's way of dealing with that is to allow feelings of shame to be activated.
Right.
And I feel the same thing happened when I would think about more recent history, like, you know, seeing those newsreels of people being hosed down
and
German shepherds being set on these nonviolent protesters that looked like my parents.
Right.
And the heartbreak of that,
right.
to feel like this is something that people do to us.
Right.
And not only theoretically, but to know that people I touch and live with had felt that,
right.
it was crushing.
Yeah.
You know?
I remember having the conversation with my mother for the first time, like, why do they hate us so much? I became so obsessed with this one book. I just found it recently as I've been clearing my parents' house. It's called Tear Down the Walls, and it was a young person's look at the civil rights movement. So it was photographs. And when I saw this book, I had written so much in it and on the sides, you know, here and on the pages, and it just, touching that book brought back all of this stuff where I just kept staring at this material thinking like, but why? And talking to them about it and spending, you know, I would go to my mom is from New Orleans, so I would go to the South every summer, but it was something different about accessing it, you know, in the book versus, you know, in their stories, like, mm-hmm. as you said, you know, hearing. So your parents didn't talk about, you didn't want to hear them.
They didn't volunteer a lot. You know, I think my parents were really concerned with wanting to give us a sense of possibility.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they didn't want to blind us to reality either.
No.
And they would find ways of saying, you know, you need to, you know, the mantra in my house is you need to be twice as good at everything you do. And that was a way of saying there are obstacles, but you can surmount them.
Right. And people are watching you, too.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the other thing. You have to be twice as good. There are obstacles, and, you know, don't let us down.
Mm-hmm.
So that idea of disappointment is so huge in this book. And it does come up, and I don't want to give it away, but that's a word that actually floats through the book. You know, you don't want to disappoint.
Yeah. But then a lot of that silence really came from me and just wanting to, anytime I sensed the opportunity for these kinds of questions or stories, I just would shut down and veer in another direction because I didn't want to feel that. Mm-hmm. And then it was really as a reader that I was able to be receptive, you know.
And who first, which writers were able to, like, push you over that bridge?
Yeah, well, I remember my first course in African American literature, reading, well, Frederick Douglass, but also maybe the second semester reading some like Ralph Ellison and Ishmael Reed and Zora Neale Hurston, and feeling, particularly with Ellison, I think that, you know, Invisible Man is so monumental, like, everything was available to me, and it was familiar from all the things I had heard and all the things that I had pushed away.
Right.
And the relationship that you have with a narrator is different from the relationship you have with an actual person, so that you can vulnerability isn't quite the same.
Right.
But the investment, I think, can be even more real feeling.
How did that shape your writing?
That's a good question. I don't know, really. To be really honest with you, this book was the first book that felt like the private experience of race became a part of mm-hmm. the huge story. Mm-hmm. I feel like as a Black American, I'm interested in these voices and social events and marginal perspectives. And a lot of the poems that I've written that are political are going toward those places, but not always because of my own private experience.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a book that invited me into a different kind of vulnerability and honesty, and also that urged me to consider the political implications of, you know, these moments in my life where I was pre-political.
Right, 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 right. And you could actually sort of, you're observing your maturity, you know, like how you evolved into yeah. that. And that was the most interesting thing to watching that moment where you start talking about, like when you're telling people, like, I'm a nationalist now,
yeah.
you know, and the classes and the, you know, you were taking and the discussions you were having, but the books were the things and those voices were the things that buttressed you
mm-hmm.
Through that period.
I remember reading Richard Wright and feeling so excited by he's such a beautiful writer, but especially in Black Boy, the way that he allows the child version of himself to trigger all of these realizations that only an adult can have mm-hmm. about race. I mean, the right. kid knows what happened, and he knows how he felt when certain things happen, but it's the adult narrator that is able to say, in choosing to go to college, or to leave the South, rather, I was derailing a whole set of obstacles that had meticulously been put in place by the political mm-hmm. structure. You know, the kids maybe felt something about the insurmountability of
right,
odds, but
right.
not in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really emboldened by the way that he allowed the adult language and knowledge to give clarity to those murky feelings.
Right.
And that was something that I feel like I really leaned on in writing this book.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, just in terms of like texts that you either went to as models, or texts that were inspiration, or texts that you read like, okay, I'm done with my writing today, and so now I need to be like, kind of, I need to be hugged. I need to be fed.
Oh.
I mean, were there things you were grabbing for that?
Well, when I needed to be hugged and fed, I would just like get a literal hug, and eat and drink. So. When I was writing this book, I was thinking, you know, Wright was somebody that I wanted to kind of have in the front of my mind, but then other writers that are thematically completely unrelated to me. So Edmund White, who is one of yeah. my colleagues at Princeton and who I think is just this wonderful writer, and I love his memoirs mm-hmm. and the way that, you know, sentences work
right.
and the way that, you know, those books feel like treatises on these different topics like friendship or New York City. And so I really love that. I was trying to also figure things out because I didn't know how to tell a story.
Right.
And I remember reading Tobias Wolff mm-hmm. and realizing, oh, okay, he has all these chapters that feel like these discrete stories, but they don't have to have a hard ending.
Right.
And I felt like really kind of educated by that.
Yeah.
Like, quiet closure allows a larger narrative arc to be implied.
Exactly.
And that was really helpful because I didn't know there was a story there. I just knew there was stuff I wanted to say.
I want to ask you, because I want to open it up in a minute, but I have more questions too, but I want to share. as I said, it's like welcome to our conversation that I wanted to have. But toward the end of the book, you say that part of the reason you were working on this book had to do when you were expecting your daughter and wanting to be able to tell her a story. Mm-hmm. And then you had the twins, your two sons. What do you hope this narrative helps them know about you and their inherited history?
Oh, gosh.
I know it's so brand new still.
Well, I told myself when I was writing it, it would help them know the people who made me, you know?
Mm.
But I know that as I was writing that this, it became a book about me.
Yeah.
And I just hope the honesty that, you know, writers are, we're our best selves in language.
Yes.
You know, I am such a better parent in language sometimes than I am. Like,
you're so honest here.
So I hope that if this is a book that would become interesting to them when they're older,
right,
they'll see a version of me that might be a good, the best version,
right.
Most fearless version.
Yeah, I was going to say the honest and fearless, yeah. And then I guess I will ask, my last question would be, how and where do you feel your mom's presence most now?
I see her in my daughter. It's so funny because I think I kind of need to imagine that there is something like reincarnation. But there have been these strange moments. There was one moment, years ago I wrote a poem about my mother and something she and her sisters liked to do when they were kids, which was to play hospital. And my mother would say, okay, go get a quilt, cover me up, I'm the patient, and give me raisins, that's my medicine. And when my daughter was about 3, she just said that, basically. Like, she said, I'm going to sit on the couch, give me my blanket, I need my blanket. I want some raisins, I'm sick.
She said the raisins detail,
and I just got a very
wonderful
feeling of fright and joy and mystery. But it's not that my daughter is very much like my mother. She's
right.
So wild, but I feel like there's something of that, the woman I wanted to know before she was a mother, mm-hmm. in there. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes I tell myself when I'm struggling to be the right kind of mother for her that this is a way of, finishing that cycle,
right,
or something like
right.
that.
Right. Oh, it's lovely. So, questions? Are we ready? Is there a mic? There's one right here.
I enjoyed all your stories and observations about your mom and family, but you said something early on that stuck with me about your poetry, and I wanted to ask you a question about that. When you said you feel it's very important to stray away or get away from the main thing that the poem is about, is it important to get back to it, or do you think the poem should end? I'm sorry, I haven't read your poetry yet to form an answer myself, but I was curious your thoughts on the subject.
I think it's a case-by-case thing. Sometimes the poem pulls you back. But what I really think is important, and what I've learned to let happen, is to trust that that trigger or the initiating idea of the poem, what I know I want to say, is really just a gateway to what I don't yet know and what can reveal itself if I'm listening in the right way. And that's usually more interesting than, whatever the topic at hand is. So it's there are different terms. The poet Robert Bly talks about the psychic, the underlying psychic material that the poem is really interested in, or Richard Hugo talks about it as the subject that's created by the poem itself. And I think it's just the thing that the unconscious mind yields as tangentially connected to where you started from, but that's also perhaps more necessary.
I understand that you're a fan of Garcia Lorca. And does any of that stem from being an African-American woman in America and identifying with him as being a gay male in Franco-era Spain? Or is it just the beauty of his poetry?
The short answer is yes. I think I got to that sense of what we were each working at after thinking about Lorca and maybe even teaching him and teaching his theory of the duende, and thinking about this idea of You know, the Duende is not simply about the art. It's primarily about a kind of dangerous artistic energy, but it's also about the will or the courage to survive what might be an insurmountable kind of struggle. And it's a struggle with the self, but as I started thinking more and more about that idea, I realized that the communities that such forms are connected to are also involved in a political struggle with something that's not the self, and that's the central culture. And that made a lot of sense to me as somebody who's Black in America. I think that that deepened my sense of interest in that theme, but initially it was really just the poetry and that really beautiful articulation of that concept that intrigued me.
Okay. Hello. I've been writing poetry for about 10 years and recently was encouraged to write longer things, and I'm challenged by writing more than a page or two at a time. And so I'm just really very curious how you found that, you know, in terms of how many hours a day or a week you're putting into the writing, having so many more pages to deal with, et cetera, et cetera. Just, yeah.
Yeah, I used to feel I remember when I first, you know, the first many years of writing poems, feeling like what a poem was a series of statements of things that I could attest to that I had figured out. And that's hard to do. It's hard to get past like that with what you know. And it took me a long time to realize that I was really more interested in poems that maybe started from knowledge and departed or deviated and went to a place of play and questioning. I've started to realize how many actual question marks occur in the poems that I love. You know, it's a moment where the speaker says, I don't know. Show me. What do I feel? What do I see? How can this answer this unanswerable question? And I got really excited trying that because it meant I could get past this. And I could, there's a lot that I don't know. And if I could get that into language, I could get onto, you know, pages and pages. And that's something that I still trust. I think I also really, I went through a period of writer's block that was rather painful. And during that time, I took up photography, you know, back in the darkroom days, and realizing how much emotional and narrative content can come from gestures within a visual image. Mm-hmm. And then realizing that you can do that in language too. Even if there's something that you've described, there's more that you can see and learn from it if you can just describe the right features of it. And so those are things that kind of help me get past that first page. Another thing I often do is write long poems that are comprised of short poems in sections.
Right.
And what I like about that is it allows me to kind of riff on a topic, and you can, you know, come at it from one direction, not even have to have a hard ending. You notice I like that idea. and then pick up and kind of, it's almost like a boxer. Okay, round two, I'm going to go at it in this other way, and just keep going until something takes shape that feels whole.
There's one over here. Right over here.
I'm aware of the frustration that you're here to talk about the memoir and people keep asking you about the poetry.
it's easier to talk about the poetry than what I did when I was a kid.
But I have to follow suit. I devoured Life on Mars, and I'm reading it for the second time, and it's just such an incredible piece of work.
Thank you.
I wanted to sort of dovetail with Linnell's earlier question, because she asked you about moving from poetry to prose. I'm curious now, having written this book, what your takeaway or what effect you feel this is having on your poetry.
I know poetry is a constant for me, and I will be back to it. One way of kind of getting back into that has been to work on some translations, and also an opera libretto, which I would never have done, but I was tricked into. but I also am really, there's a lot of stuff that I think might be well suited to essays that I'd like to work on in prose. I think that the sense of fidelity to a single genre is kind of silly. We get, speaking of being tricked, I feel like we get tricked into that, especially in MFA programs, where you say, okay, I'm going to go through the poetry track, and it's better than all the others. And when in reality, language is language, and there are different approaches to questions that we should feel comfortable taking. Mm-hmm. So I know my poetry will probably change, but I think it changes from work to work anyway, because I have to come up from air and figure out how to say something different than what I just said. So we'll see what that is.
I have a question for you, academically speaking. How do you feel about the growing trend for students in college asking for trigger warnings from professors and all of that to have a warning label put on a wonderful book like this? And what's your take on that? How do you deal with that? And what would you advise for writers that may end up finding themselves having to put warning labels on their own work someday?
Did you see me just start to roll my eyes and pray and catch it? This is what I think in a nutshell. I feel that the language of, for shorthand, I'll call it the language of the market, urges us to nullify, nuance, and simplify things and shy away from discomfort because we're buying things and we want to feel good. I feel this happening in university settings as well, where students sometimes approach the courses as though they're consumers when they're not. And I think that the idea of trigger warnings and wanting to be preserved from the very real and uncomfortable realizations that literature is designed to foster is what's the right adjective? I think it's bad. I know that if there is, so this is a long project I must try and write another time, but if we buy into the simplified language that's coming at us from all directions, including our phones and social media and the TV, and then we lose the ability to have conversations about what these things make us feel, and we lose the ability to trust being wrong, and those are things that are probably deadening to culture. Mm-hmm.
Good evening. Isabel Wilkerson, who wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, said that we needed to get the stories from the people who, the generations that migrated. And now you stated that maybe you felt shame because of those stories. So my question to you is, do you think that the people who migrated chose not to speak those stories because of maybe the shame that they felt?
That's such a good and a painful question. I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's there are ways these stories come down. I know even in my family, humor is a way that some of these things come down, you know? Even if I don't think shame is really exactly, but maybe this idea that how can I burden you? I came here so you wouldn't have to deal with this. How can I burden you with this? And yet I need you to know this too. And I think humor is one way that these things get transferred and we learn to laugh at what you don't have and laugh at what you have been made to recover from. And that's productive. And I'm sure that a lot of the things that I recoiled from, I was receptive to in that other form, you know, of stories that might have been playful. But I think it's something that happens, you know, if there's something that needs to come out, even in our bodies, it finds a way out. And I imagine that in families and generations, there are whole ways of getting around the problem of silence, you know.
So can I ask her to? Okay. I really want to ask you to read a poem to end.
Okay.
Okay.
Pick. I will.
All right. Thank you.
I'll end with... with a poem called The Universe's Primal Scream. It's kind of an elegy, an unintentional elegy. The universe as primal scream. 5 p.m. on the nose. They open their mouths and it rolls out, high, shrill, and metallic. First the boy, then his sister. Occasionally, they both let loose at once, and I think of putting on my shoes to go up and see whether it is merely an experiment their parents have been conducting upon the good crystal, which must surely lie shattered to dust on the floor. Maybe the mother is still proud of the 4 pink lungs she nursed to such might. Perhaps if they hit the magic decibel, the whole building will lift off and will ride to glory like Elijah. If this is it, if this is what their cries are cocked toward, let the sky pass from blue to red to molten gold to black. Let the heaven we inherit approach. Whether it is our dead in Old Testament robes, or a door opening onto the roiling infinity of space, whether it will bend down to greet us like a father or swallow us like a furnace. I'm ready to meet what refuses to let us keep anything for long, what teases us with blessings, bends us with grief. Wizard, thief, the great wind rushing to knock our mirrors to the floor, to sweep our short lives clean. How mean our racket seems beside it. My stereo on shuffle, the neighbor chopping onions through a wall. All of it just a hiccup against what may never come for us. And the kids upstairs still at it, screaming like the dawn of man, as if something they have no name for has begun to insist upon being born.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your question. So great.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.